Back now with Day to Day. Imagine a global summit, but instead of world leaders, you assemble musicians. To make his latest album, composer-producer Jamshid Sharifi did just that. Day to Day contributor Derek Rath spoke with Jamshid Sharifi and has this review of his new album. It's called One.
It's too bad the larger world can't be more like the world of musicians, where cultural differences are viewed in a positive way, as a source of inspiration, not suspicion. The title of Jamshid Sharifi's new album refers to that coming together.
The inspiration for the record's title is a very simple observation that I had while working with so many artists from around the world is that, you know, that what unites us is so much greater than what separates us. It's so easy for us to find common ground.
The title track, One, exemplifies an effortless fusion. It includes Tibetan, West African and Japanese vocals, Egyptian oud and talking drums in a rich orchestral palette. Jamshid's own upbringing. Born and raised in Topeka, Kansas, he was exposed to Middle Eastern music and jazz by his Iranian father. His American mother taught him European classical and church music. He went on to study jazz piano, composition, and film scoring at Berklee College in Boston. And you can hear all these elements on this track, Setar, featuring Susan Dehim on vocals.
It is a record in which you can hear definitely the hand of an arranger, and you can also hear people improvising. You know, I wanted to give space for some of the great players that I knew.
It's a transcultural all-star ensemble. Jamshid, himself a multi-instrumentalist, wrote much of the material with specific instrumentalists and singers in mind, including some of the best-known world music stars. Listen to these names: Hassan Hakmoon, Abdullah Jabate, Paula Cole, Yongchen Lamo, and Vishal Vaid. You can hear their inspiration on every track, and the results are dramatic.
Every one of them brought more to the table than I would have expected. Those things altered, in some cases, the form of the track. Absolutely, they altered the balance of other elements. I remember several of the vocalists coming up with parts, especially some of the rhythmic chanting things that you hear in the background, and those, of course, affected the piece. I mean, really, every phase of the process would send me back to the drawing board.
In the track Darfur is Burning, Jamshid orchestrates a kaleidoscope of music from both the East and the West. Darfur is Burning was inspired by the work of writer Primo Levi, an Italian survivor of Auschwitz.
He said, "People have said about the Holocaust never again, and yet it's happened already." And he pointed to Cambodia, and he says it will happen again, and we are, it seems, powerless to stop it.
There is wry political commentary elsewhere as well. Take the title of this track, as most que ma most.
Which basically means the terrible situation that we find ourselves in is one of our own making. I was trying to think of a suitable title for the Iraq War. I thought maybe a shorthand for that would be, we really stepped in it this time.
One poignant moment comes in Requiem, dedicated to those who lost their lives on 9/11. It's personal, as Sharifi lived in Lower Manhattan, just blocks from Ground Zero.
That track is a response to that. The voices that you hear running through it very softly are my wife and daughter doing a very innocent, kind of almost like a pygmy chant. And, you know, I just wanted to write something that reflected the sadness of the moment for me, the sense of so many people being lost.
Essentially, Jamshid Sharifi's CD 1 is a celebration of international musicians exploring and thriving on their differences, becoming one. For NPR News, this is Derek Rath.
Want more? You can hear full songs from Jamshid Sharifi's new album at our music website, npr.org/music.
Hey, Madeline, you weren't here yesterday.
No.
You missed the announcement about our new series. It's actually called Hold Your Nose.
Hold Your Nose?
Yeah, it's kind of about the election, you know.
Oh.
Some conservatives say, I don't like John McCain. I'm going to hold my nose and vote for him.
But some people say, if my candidate's not in, I'm not voting at all, right?
Exactly. I'm not holding my nose. Okay, we want to hear from listeners. What do you think about this? What is the correct path? Political virtue, hold your nose, or is that a vice? So, website npr.org/daytoday. Click contact daytoday there and put nose in the subject line.
Daytoday is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com.
Now, everybody knows the Library of Congress has a huge catalog of books and printed materials. But in the year 2000, Congress also gave the library the additional mandate of creating a national recording registry. Its mission? To select 25 recordings each year that are culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. The 2007 inductees were announced earlier this month. The list ranges from the first transatlantic broadcast recording in 1925 to The Sounds of Earth, an LP created for the Voyager spacecraft in 1977. To introduce other life forms to, well, the sounds of Earth. Thankfully, there was also some music. Here to tell us about that is Oliver Huang. He's a cultural critic and a sociology professor at Cal State Long Beach who visits with us from time to time to keep us up to date on cultural happenings. Oliver, welcome. Nice to talk to you again.
Yes, glad to be here.
So let's take a look at some of the songs on the registry. One that popped out for you was Oh Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison. Let's listen to that for just a little bit.
Pretty woman walking down the street. Woman, the kind I like to meet, pretty woman. I don't believe you, you're not the truth. No one could look as good as you.
So apart from being the inspiration or the soundtrack or whatever of a hit Julia Roberts movie, why is this song important?
Well, it's funny because, you know, it's not my personal favorite Orbison song, even though I think it's a great song. I've always preferred Only the Lonely. But, you know, Pretty Woman sold something like 7 million copies, which, especially by these standards, it's almost impossible to imagine a single having that kind of popularity. And especially at the time when it came out, I think in the mid-1960s, it broke in both the U.S. and the U.K., the Beatles' stranglehold on the charts. So it was a really important and, again, immensely successful and popular single. And as you point out, you could say that it inadvertently launched Julia Roberts' career in an elliptical way. So,
why do you think it was so popular?
I mean, the way that the song opens with those guitar chords, you know, in that hard-driving backbeat, it's just so striking. It, you know, you can see how it works on the dance floor. It's got a great hook in terms of Oh Pretty Woman. It's easy to remember. So, you know, as a pop song, and all these dynamics come together really well on that single song.
Okay, so this song made a lot of waves in 1964. Apparently it also made some waves in 1994 when it was sampled by Two Live Crew. Do you want to hear a little bit of that?
Yeah, sure. Right.
Walking down the street. Pretty woman. Girl, you look so sweet. Pretty woman. You
I haven't heard that song in about 20 years. I think Two Live Crew got sued over that in terms of copyright infringement because they didn't clear the sample. And, you know, this came out at a time when there were a lot of rappers being sued by artists. The Turtles sued De La Soul over something they had used. Gilbert O'Sullivan had sued Biz Markie. And in those cases, the rappers lost. But in Two Live Crew's case, they argued the song was actually satire and a parody. And on that basis, they were able to actually win the case in their favor because, you know, for satirical purposes, that's allowable sampling. And so Two Live Crew, I think, avoided a major financial bullet on that one.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, let's listen to another song that came out in the 60s. This is from 1965, and it's Smokey Robinson with Tracks of My Tears.
So take a good look at my face. You'll see my smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easy to trace the tracks of my tears.
Why do you think the Library of Congress picked this song?
Well, the registry has been really good to Motown. No Motown artist made the first year, I think, which was 2002. But since then, they've had at least three other Motown artists, including Martha and the Vandellas, Marvin Gaye, and most recently Stevie Wonder. And so Smokey and the Miracles are, I think, the fourth Motown group to be included. And with them in particular, I mean, they were such an integral part to Motown's success in the early 1960s. I think they were the first band that Berry Gordy signed. Their string of hits helped really launch the label and get its footing. And Smokey Robinson in particular, as a singer-songwriter, was such a pivotal and integral force to Motown's success in the 1960s in terms of he wrote so many of their major hits, not just for himself and the Miracles, but also for the Temptations and other Motown artists.
Let's move into the 70s with Herbie Hancock and his album Headhunters. And let's listen to Watermelon Man. What do you think the Library was recognizing with this song, and why do you think we still like it?
Well, I think for one thing, you know, it was the best-selling jazz album, at least in that era, which still blows my mind because we're talking about an album, and with Watermelon Man in particular, this is a song that combines everything from pygmy chanting, which opens the song, to those really heavy P-funk rhythms. I think that's Paul Jackson on bass there. And the idea that that would have this mass audience, at least in hindsight, seems really surprising to me, especially because fusion jazz has gotten such an immense bad rap from some so-called jazz purists. But to me, especially with the Headhunters album, it had this, you know, really great combination of these creative collisions of musical styles, but still based around something that's really physically appealing because it's incorporating these funk and soul rhythms. It doesn't hurt that it also has one of the most memorable album covers that I can think of.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is true. Okay, the last recording that the Library included on the 2007 registry is the best-selling album of all time. This should be a Trivial Pursuit question. Probably is a Trivial Pursuit question. What is it, Oliver? Tell me.
I wish I could do the Dave Chappelle voice and say, no, it's Thriller.
It's Thriller. That's right. What else can you tell us about Thriller and its cultural significance?
Well, I think as you noted, I mean, it's the best-selling pop album of all time. I think it sold something like 27 million copies. It still continues to sell exceptionally well, even 25 years later. And I mean, the thing that really, really blows my mind is, you know, seven of its singles made the top 10, which is, again, by today's standards, that's really difficult to imagine unless, you know, Hannah Montana, T-Pain, and Carrie Underwood collaborated to make some fusion album. You know, just the achievement that Thriller was able to execute is just really, really amazing.
There's something about that group dance scene that sort of sums up the time for me, you know, where everybody's kind of throwing down as a group. It's kind of like the My Generation's West Side Story, I think. Well, you know, you all sort of imagined yourself in the video, you know, somewhere. You know?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I mean, I would add that I think one of the things about Thriller is that it really benefited from MTV and the kind of exposure that music videos changed our perception, our relationship to pop music, because now we had a visual set of things to go with it. And you can't listen to Thriller and not think about you know, the dance scene in it. You can't think about Billie Jean without, you know, those dance steps that he would do in those lighted tiles. And so I think that our memories of Thriller are very much connected not just to sort of the acoustic qualities, but the visual qualities. And that's something that Thriller really benefited from, which is the rise of MTV coincides with the rise of Thriller.
Okay, well, come visit us out east and we'll have a dance-off.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Oliver Wong is a culture critic, a soul curator, and a professor at Cal State Long Beach. He joined us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Oliver, thanks so much for talking to us.
A pleasure as always.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We hope you have a great Memorial Day. Let's talk more tomorrow.